This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, July 11th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. And we begin today with the growing list of contacts and meetings between associates of President Donald Trump and Russians. Over the weekend, we learned that in June of 2016, three key members of the campaign met with a Russian lawyer with ties to the Kremlin because that lawyer said she had damaging information about Trump's opponent, Hillary Clinton. And then last night, a revelation that puts the meeting and others like it in a whole new light. The New York Times reports that the president's oldest son, Donald Trump Jr., was told beforehand in an email that the information the lawyer had was part of a Russian government effort to damage Clinton. The Times has now obtained a copy of that email, which stated that the information, quote, would incriminate Hillary and her dealings with Russia and would be very useful to your father, end quote. And also said, this is obviously very high level and sensitive information, but is part of Russia and its government's support for Mr. Trump, end quote. Donald Trump Jr.'s reply, if it's what you say, I love it, especially later in the summer, end quote. It's a stunning revelation. Now, the Russian lawyer in question is named Natalia Veselitskaya, and on NBC's Today show this morning, she denied any connection to the Kremlin.
Have you ever worked for the Russian government? Do you have connections to the Russian government?
Yep.
But also in that June 9th meeting, Paul Manafort, who was President Trump's campaign manager at the time, and Jared Kushner, who did not initially disclose this meeting on security clearance forms as required by intelligence agencies. Donald Trump Jr. gave a third statement to the New York Times explaining the meeting. He said after pleasantries were exchanged, the woman stated that she had information that individuals connected to Russia were funding the Democratic National Committee and supporting Mrs. Clinton. Her statements were vague, ambiguous, and made no sense. No details or supporting information was provided or even offered. It quickly became clear that she had no meaningful information. Ryan Goodman is a former special counsel for the Department of Defense and founding co-editor of Just Security. It's a forum on law, rights, and U.S. national security.
What's so remarkable here is that the initial statement on the record by Donald Trump Jr. is on its own fairly incriminating, because in it, at least the second time when he changed his story to an admission that the conversation was about Hillary Clinton and the connection to the Russian government or Russian information, he basically is admitting that that was the purpose of the meeting, because he in fact says that that was the pretext for the meeting, and then this lawyer tried to turn the conversation afterwards to something about adoption. So we already know, according to his own statement, that he was intending to meet with somebody that was going to provide useful information to him. So the one aspect of what he said on Sunday that was helpful to his case is that he claimed that he had no knowledge of who the person was beforehand or that she was a Russian national or anything like it. The most recent revelation from the New York Times in the last 24 hours is, in fact, the third turn on this story, which says, no, indeed, he was notified by email in writing that the purpose of the meeting was that the Russian government had information.
What interest might this potentially be to Robert Mueller, the special counsel, and investigators from the Justice Department?
I think the primary interest is the question of, was there collusion or what I would describe as coordination between the Trump campaign and Russia or the Russian government during the election season. And the key question here is that it actually does not matter whether or not this was a Russian government agent, but rather that it was a Russian national. Our election laws are very clear that you cannot solicit or accept any contribution or thing of value – that's the terminology that's used – from a foreign national in a campaign. So if the Russians were giving things of value, such as promises of Clinton's emails or the DNC emails, then that alone would be sufficient under the law, under federal campaign finance law, which prohibits foreign nationals from making those kinds of contributions. And anybody who's like an American that would solicit or accept such a contribution could be criminally liable.
So that's campaign finance law, which is important. Many Americans have been also focused on the idea that you mentioned, coordination or collusion. Does the notification that Donald Trump Jr. got here, that the Russian government was behind the information he and others would receive at this meeting, point to anything that illuminates coordination or collusion?
So I think it does provide evidence of that. The idea here is that this is the earliest meeting that we know of, and it seems to set the ball rolling. What the Donald Trump Jr. and then in that meeting with Paul Manafort, the campaign director, and Donald Trump Sr.'s son-in-law, Jared Kushner, are essentially saying to the Russians is that they would appreciate their help.
Now, Donald Trump Jr., of course, lied to the New York Times the first time he was asked about this, later said more about it before this latest revelation. Also in the room, as we mentioned, however, Paul Manafort, who was the campaign manager at the time, and Jared Kushner. Now, Jared Kushner, who's a senior White House advisor now and a government employee, did not initially disclose this meeting on security clearance forms where he's required to.
That's right. That was actually the second item of great legal significance that I think comes out of this meeting. It is a federal crime to provide false information on those security forms. False information includes omission. If you do not tell the federal government that you've had contacts with foreign nationals, especially if, now that we know about this email, it's a foreign national that was coming in with a connection to the foreign government, Russia. I think what's very significant about the Donald Trump Jr. imbroglio of the June meeting is its implications for Jared Kushner. It is not as easily plausible. It's no longer plausible, I would say, even in my opinion, that he can say that it was an innocent oversight not to report the meeting. Here's one of the major reasons why. He could otherwise have said, look, I had so many meetings with foreign nationals and representatives of governments over time. But the reason that you have to give that information to the government on a security form is because they want to know, has anybody tried to influence you and influence your behavior in government? That's what the meeting was about, even by Donald Trump Jr.'s own admission. So that's what's, I think, quite devastating. I do think that that means that the Mueller could hold this over the head of Kushner, and that's what would happen in a normal investigation. You'd have a clear legal violation where somebody's got a great deal of exposure to criminal liability. And from that, he could move to turning him, flipping him, so that he could provide more information to the investigation about other matters.
We mentioned that the lawyer in this meeting, Natalia Veselnitskaya, denies now vehemently that she has any connections to the Russian government whatsoever. Does that make a difference any longer now that this email apparently exists where Rob Goldstone confirms to Donald Trump Jr. that indeed it is the Russian government who has information?
I think it proves the lie in a certain sense. It's a strong indication that she's just I don't have a softer term for it, that she's lying. It was already suspicious that somebody that is so otherwise connected to representing Russian government interests, that has been lobbying so hard on behalf of the interests of at least the Russian government with respect to lifting of human rights sanctions, which is a huge project for Putin himself, would say that, oh, you know, after this meeting, I didn't say a word to the Russian government about it. I just think that on its own was highly implausible. Now that we have the email, it looks like it's an outright lie.
Ryan Goodman, I've noticed as this meeting has been revealed since before the weekend and in the days since, that there's been a shifting set of explanations from people associated with the Trump White House, basically going from denying that any coordination with Russians could have ever taken place to a different kind of explanation that maybe it wasn't so bad or maybe it was innocent, even if this meeting did take place. And many other campaign operatives, Republicans who've participated in other campaigns, have since said that, and maybe it's easy to say now, but they've said that if this had happened to them, if a meeting like this had been set up or if they had gotten an email like the one they got from Rob Goldstone, they would have called the FBI, not taken the meeting and called investigators.
I think that's right. And at the very least, after that meeting takes place, the first thing you've got to be thinking about is we've got to call the FBI. immediately. So the fact that this has never been disclosed until this moment, that it's broken in the news, is another indication that there's a kind of an illicit intent or purpose, or might even say a criminal intent or purpose.
And let's continue to look for a second at Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, because this meeting that we've been discussing June 9th is not the only one that Kushner failed to disclose, certainly not the only one that he took. And we read news earlier in the spring that indeed he was interested in setting up back-channel communications with Russians, potentially using Russian communications equipment.
So there's this also startling piece of news that broke that Kushner meets directly with Ambassador Kislyak from Russia and Michael Flynn in Trump Tower in early December and tries to set up this offline communication. And the most unusual aspect of it seems to be that he says, why don't we meet inside the Russian embassy or consul so that he can have direct communications with Moscow? It is difficult to conceive of a good reason that anybody would try to set something up like that. The most charitable explanation I can think of on behalf of Kushner would be that he was a neophyte, a novice, and that he was not skilled in foreign policy or the understandings of the workings of governments and diplomacy, so that he came up with a little bit of a harebrained idea. But even that doesn't seem to fly because he's sitting in the room with Michael Flynn, who would you would imagine would put the kibosh on something like that, saying, of course, we would not really pursue it or some way or another. So that's just something startling about Kushner in particular.
So, Ryan Goodman, before we let you go, there's a great deal of information that Americans are learning now. Let's take a step back. The intelligence community, the FBI, the CIA, and others have concluded that Russia intervened in the 2016 election to tilt it in favor of Donald Trump. We've learned now about this meeting with Donald Trump Jr., where he was informed that the information against Donald Trump's opponent that he would get came from the Russian government. You're taking all of this in as well as a former special counsel. Where do we sit?
So I think we sit, unfortunately, for our country, on something of a kind of a political bombshell, if not a legal bombshell. It seems as though we now have very specific information that says that that campaign was soliciting and encouraging the activities of the Russian government. It's just so difficult to escape that conclusion if you look at the evidence in a kind of as reasonable a manner as possible.
And what does that mean?
Well, I think that that means potential criminal violations of campaign finance law, which happens to be the law that would actually most directly apply as a criminal matter to collusion slash coordination. When people ask, well, what would be the crime, that's the clearest case of it.
Ryan Goodman is former special counsel for the Department of Defense and founding co-editor of Just Security, a forum on law, rights, and U.S. national security. Ryan Goodman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Veterans Affairs Secretary David Shulkin is one of the few cabinet holdovers from the Obama administration. Shulkin is a private medical doctor who left his practice to become Undersecretary of Health for the VA, and he was named by President Trump to head the organization with a rare unanimous confirmation from the Senate. Shulkin heads the VA at a time of reform. Two major wars have produced a flood of veterans coming home and needing care for the physical and emotional scars of battle. In 2014, long waiting lists at clinics caused some veterans to go without care.
I think it was the perfect storm. Not only were we seeing large numbers of service members returning from active conflict with very severe injuries, both physical and emotional, but it was also the time that the Vietnam veterans were just turning on average about 65 years old. And so we were having a large influx of both older veterans requiring more care as well as our younger veterans requiring more care. So that was one issue. The second issue is that we have failed to give people who work in the VA the proper tools and systems that they deserve to take care of our veterans. So a lot of what I'm doing is bringing best practices from the private sector into the VA, modernizing the VA systems to give them the tools to be able to handle the types of situations that they're faced with every day taking care of veterans, and providing the right amount of resources so that we can meet the demand required upon us.
Right. So those are some of your reforms that you're attempting to bring in. And you just mentioned the word resources, which means money, which Congress has increased. But I want to talk about sheer numbers that the VA is dealing with now, because so many young people have come home from major wars post 9/11. A 50% increase in veterans qualifying for care between 2007 and 2013. And the total number of inpatient visits from 63 million to 92 million. You talked about resources, but the fact is that there's an enormous increase, really a tidal wave of veterans who now need care.
Right. As we were fixing the access issues in VA, I let everybody know that our wait times would actually probably go up before they go down because we had ignored that demand on our services for quite some time. And what we learned is that as we made more appointments available, more and more people were coming to the VA to get services. We've seen 7 million more appointments this year alone than last year. So we are just now reaching the point that I think that we are addressing the true demand of the VA healthcare system.
$500 million Congress has sent your way to deal with this influx of veterans who need care. Is it gonna need to be more?
The problems in the VA are not solely a money issue. And I do not believe that we should be looking for large increases in funding for the years that are coming in the future. I think what we're trying to do is to modernize our system so we can become more efficient, more productive, and make sure that we're providing the right services by implementing best practices and modernizing the current systems we have, not necessarily more money.
Mr. Secretary, you recently used your authority to change some of the rules there at the VA when it comes to emergency treatment for vets suffering from PTSD. And we had a veteran and an advocate on the show named Christopher Goldsmith. He works for the Vietnam Veterans of America, and he's an Iraq vet himself who got a less than honorable discharge because of a suicide attempt. He missed a deployment. But he had this to say.
The secretary has gone as far as he can, without top cover from President Trump and without the support of Congress. We need everybody, and we need the average voter to get engaged on this issue and say that every single veteran who has PTSD deserves access to mental health care.
And Mr. Secretary, he added to that that while he supports the reforms, he called it putting a Band-Aid over a gunshot wound. How do you respond?
Well, I admire his passion on this, and I think that he's got a lot that makes sense in his comments. Our top priority is to make sure that we're helping veterans, and the biggest clinical priority is reducing veteran suicide. And if you don't allow people access to health care and to behavioral health care services, I don't know how you're going to begin to address that. I was tired of waiting, and I just acted, and as of July 5th, any veteran who has another than honorable discharge just needs to come to the VA, and we're going to provide them those emergency mental health services because it's the right thing to do. But I agree with Mr. Goldsmith. We need to do more than that.
And do you have a sense that appropriations bills, VA funding bills, are going to attempt to fund this type of expansion in mental health care?
Well, Secretary, I'm simply not going to allow us to pass bills and not provide us the resources to be able to carry them out. And so I see this very much as a partnership with Congress. We've had a very good relationship in being able to match what they're asking us to do with the resources that we need. That's why I believe our budget this year for fiscal year 18 has gone up, and it allows us to be able to carry out our mission.
Mr. Secretary, one of the other key reforms that Congress decided on was letting veterans, especially those who live in rural areas, maybe not close to one of your VA hospitals, go to see a private doctor. This was a controversial reform. There's some fear that it could undermine the VA if patients start going elsewhere for their care. How's it working out so far? And do you have a fear that it could undermine VA facilities if patients can just go see private doctors?
This was a program that Congress acted on initially in the 2014 wait time crisis. And in fact, I think that the program has been successful and achieved the results, which is to allow veterans that weren't able to get care in a reasonable way to be able to go into the community. And we've seen millions of veterans now who would have had trouble getting care, being able to get care closer to home. And I think that's a good thing. And I support the continuation of a program like that. My goal is to build a system that takes advantage of the very best that VA has to offer veterans and the best that the private sector in the community has to offer veterans, and to create a single integrated experience, a seamless system of care that where the private sector works with VA. That is in no means moving towards privatization of VA. To the contrary, I believe that VA is an essential national resource. It's tied to our national security. It's important for us to honor our commitment to our veterans to keep a VA strong and robust.
David Shulkin, Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Mr. Secretary, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go to Seattle now, where an increase in the minimum wage has produced some confusing and controversial results. In 2014, Seattle moved to incrementally raise its minimum wage to $15 an hour. And there was a recent study which looked at the increase when it was at $13 an hour. And the study has some people questioning the move. Researchers at the University of Washington found that hours clocked by low-wage workers fell, and in the end, Seattle's workers lost an average of $125 a month because of the mandated increase. Now, not all economists agree with the study and how it was conducted, but it's definitely raised questions of how far cities and states should go when raising their minimum wage. Ben Castleman is chief economics writer for 538, and he joins me now. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Todd.
Well, this study in Seattle was controversial, as I mentioned, but what did we learn about raising the minimum wage to the neighborhood of $13, $14, or $15 an hour and how it could affect low-wage workers?
Yeah, I mean, so I think it's sort of worth taking a very quick step back here and thinking about the context, which is that we've had decades of research on the minimum wage, but that research has tended to focus on much more modest increases at a much lower level, right? The federal minimum wage is at $7.25. We kind of know what happens if we were to raise that to $7.50 or $8. But when we start talking about minimum wages at $12 and $13 and $15 an hour, we really don't have much context for that. And so Seattle is kind of at the leading edge of this. Their minimum wage, at least for some companies, is now at $15 an hour. And this University of Washington study sort of took a look at what happened there, and its findings were that it ended up hurting the very low-wage workers that it was meant to help.
One of the things I read about this study and about the effect that it may have had on workers on the ground is that places like restaurants, given that they had to pay more, just focused on higher-wage workers with more experience. They said, okay, let's retain those people and not hire as many people at the low end, essentially knocking out what you might think of as the bottom rung of the ladder.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, with all of these policies, right, there are winners and there are losers. And so if you're a company in Seattle and you employ low-wage workers, now you have to pay more. You look for people who have the experience and the skills to be worth that kind of money. And so if you're a relatively experienced worker in Seattle right now, you probably benefited. But if you're a teenager, if you're somebody who's just trying to get into the labor market or trying to get back into the labor market, or you don't have much in the way of experience or skills, then at least according to this study, you might end up losing out.
What are some of the criticisms of what this study in Seattle may have missed?
There are some specific methodological concerns with it. It had to, for some sort of picky data reasons, had to skip over a lot of so-called multi-site businesses, a lot of chain restaurants, which of course are major employers of low-wage workers. They had to look only in the state of Washington. And probably the biggest issue here is that the Seattle economy is booming. And so it's really difficult to tease out to the extent that there have been changes in the economy, what of that is because of the minimum wage versus what of that is due to the booming Seattle economy. I think what we sort of need to look at in the bigger picture here is this was a high-quality study. It had some very good data that had some concerning findings. That doesn't mean it's the last word on it, but it does sort of give pause to stop and think about what the evidence is on either side.
So, Ben Castleman, before we let you go, that pause comes at a time, as we mentioned, where cities and jurisdictions across the country are moving to increase their minimum wage. San Francisco, New York, places in Oregon, Seattle, we mentioned. There are many others. What do we know now about that critical sweet spot, that Rubicon? You want to raise minimum wages because it gives low-income people more money. At some point, there's a point where you cross over and you make it harder for people to hire. What do we know about where that point is?
This study would suggest that in Seattle, $13 started to get to that limit. And what's concerning about that, and again, we're going to have to do more research, but what's concerning about that is Seattle is a very high-cost, high-wage city. You know, it's on par with New York and with San Francisco. We're starting to see these really high minimum wages spread to other areas, to places with lower costs of living, where they might have a bigger negative impact. And so if Seattle can't stand $13 or $15, that really does raise questions about what might happen in some other cities where the cost of living is lower.
Ben Castleman, chief economics writer for 538. Thanks, Ben.
Thanks so much for having me.
Over the past few months, we've talked about how sanctuary cities from San Francisco to Minneapolis are refusing to cooperate with federal crackdowns on undocumented immigrants. But federal raids in public spaces from houses to courtrooms continue across the country, highlighting the clash between Washington and cities when it comes to immigration enforcement. New York City has the largest undocumented immigrant population in the United States, an estimated 525,000 as of 2014. And the question of who gets protected and who doesn't is being tested daily. Takeaway producer Oliver Lazarus has the story.
Here in New York City, people of every color, race, and creed have been learning to live together. What New York has done, the rest of America can do.
New York, the city of immigrants. It's the city's motto. So, if any city is going to be a sanctuary, it's New York. And that's not just some rhetoric. From New York Governor Al Smith in the 1940s,
we have a record of assimilating more different kinds of people than any city in the world.
To Mayor Rudy Giuliani, who sounds very different today than he did here in the 90s.
If they seek to use city services that are critical to their health and safety, then their names will not be turned into the Immigration and Naturalization Service.
To current Mayor Bill de Blasio.
This is a city of immigrants. We always have been. This is our fundamental nature.
They've all publicly stated New York City would protect undocumented immigrants.
People, regardless of documentation status, know they can report a crime and know that information will be used to keep us all safe, but it will not be used to deport them.
But it's that last issue about police not reporting undocumented immigrants, the basis of sanctuary city policy, that's being tested in the first year of the Trump administration. Immigration attorney Lori Zeno experienced this change firsthand. When she walked into the Queens Criminal Courthouse in early spring for an arraignment hearing, ICE was waiting.
We had a client who came in through central booking. Then when his case got called into arraignment, we were informed at that point ICE was in the courtroom and they wanted to take him into custody.
Zeno said she and her client were completely caught off guard.
We didn't know anything about it ahead of time. ICE comes into the courthouse and they are in plain clothes. Since they're in, you know, jeans and shirts, we have no idea who they are.
About a half day passed between when Zeno's client was put in the system early in the morning and his appearance in the courthouse. So how did ICE know? She asked around.
Nobody knew. The only explanation that they would give was, well, the person gets fingerprinted, and then the fingerprints go to Albany, and from there, all agencies have access to that information. Although, if you know anything about the system, it just doesn't make sense. We found out that there was a note section on a computer screen that tracks where everybody is when they get arrested. And on that note section is where it indicated the PAA name.
That's Police Administrative Aide, an NYPD employee who enters in data and in this case sits behind the courtroom in a place known as central booking. So Zeno got a glimpse of the PAA's computer screen.
And then his notes were called ICE, spoke to agent so-and-so, agent phone number, blah, blah, blah. That conversation goes back and forth, figuring out when ICE will come into the courtroom, and then they notify the court. DA knows ICE is coming. Everybody knows ICE is coming. And then we walk out, and we start an arraignment. And the next thing we know, the DA says, well, we'll consent to ROR in this case because ICE is here and they're ready to pick up the defendant. And we're like, what?
ROR, released on own recognizance. So Zeno's client was let go just to be picked up and taken into ICE custody. When Zeno recognized what was going on and saw her client being put in cuffs, she asked for a warrant. And the ICE agent's response?
There is none. Yes, there is none.
And this isn't just a one-off.
There have been 28 arrests ripping immigrant New Yorkers from their families, their jobs, their communities, simply because they went to court.
That's Tina Luongo of the Legal Aid Society speaking on the steps of City Hall, where this issue is being debated.
So every single day we see the ratcheting up of ICE coming into our courts, disobeying our due process, disobeying our laws, disobeying the Constitution, and disobeying this city's sanctuary city.
I wish I could define what a sanctuary city is, but there's certainly no consensus definition.
And that's Nisha Agarwal, the city commissioner for immigrant affairs.
I think in New York City, we'd rather just think of ourselves as being a city that's open, inclusive to all, including immigrant communities, regardless of immigration status.
She says that there's only so much that the city can do. They devoted millions in this year's budget to provide some form of protection for undocumented immigrants. But as for things like ICE agents appearing in court, that's actually a state issue.
There are limits to what we can do, right? So in terms of arrests in public places, in terms of even ICE's ability to, you know, knock on people's doors and go to their homes to make arrests, we do know that ICE is showing up in court, but it's just absolutely not true that NYPD is tipping ICE off to people that are showing up in courts or that there's any kind of collaboration in that regard happening. I know there's been a lot of discussion about it, but it's just simply not true.
Here's attorney Lori Zeno again. Her case seems to contradict Agarwal's message.
We're either a sanctuary city or we're not. Don't talk out of the other side of your mouth. Don't tell people they're safe to come to the courthouses and to come to, you know, and they're safe walking around New York City when they're not.
But there's one caveat to the Zeno case that I should mention, and it gets to the heart of the deeper gray areas of the sanctuary city designation.
It's not the most sympathetic case. This particular client had previously been convicted of a crime. And then was deported and then snuck back into the country and then was arrested on another crime. And that's what he was in arraignments for. And they were both sexual abuse cases.
In any jurisdiction, Zeno's client should be deported. His crimes, or at least the one for which he was convicted, fall within the city's list of 170 crimes for which they'll comply with ICE requests to detain someone and will refuse free legal representation. On top of all that, he's already been deported once. But Zeno says that doesn't mean his due process rights should be eroded, so that ICE can show up in plain clothes in the courthouse, work with the NYPD to set his release, and just whisk him away, all without a warrant.
The point is we have to be careful what we allow to happen and who we allow to happen to, because when the system is allowed to go outside of the boundaries by having a warrant, having these due process hearings, then once all the violent felony people are gone and once all the gang people are gone, who's next? I don't want to see a fallout in a city based on a claim of being a sanctuary city when, in fact, when it comes right down to the reality of what actually happens, we're not. Because Trump is saying he's only going after these group of people, right? This group of people, this one, this one, this one. And that's who we're not protecting anyway. So what's the point?
For a few days after he was detained, Zeno lost track of her client, but she eventually found out he was deported. For The Takeaway, I'm Oliver Lazarus.
You can hear all of our reports in this series. Head over to our website at thetakeaway.org/sanctuarycities. The National Park Service turned 100 years old in 2016, and to celebrate, intrepid couple Jonathan Irish and Stephanie Payne went on a trip. They set out to visit every national park in America in 1 year. Jonathan is a photographer represented by National Geographic, and Stephanie works for NASA as a communications strategist. But this wasn't some cushy trip.
If you were to look at it on a map, it would look like a kind of a snake, actually. Like, we worked our way up the East Coast as far north as we could before we hit too much weather.
There are 59 parks in the national park system, from Maine to Alaska, all the way to American Samoa. Jonathan explains the couple began in Everglades National Park in Florida on January 1st, 2016, to give a warm start to an epic, nearly 50,000-mile journey.
We made it as far north as Cuyahoga Valley in Ohio, kind of in the early spring, and then went southwest from there through Hot Springs, Arkansas, all the way to Texas. So we got tired of the cold weather and immediately went southwest to Texas and then worked kind of north through that, through Death Valley and west, kind of on our way up towards Alaska, working up the west coast of California. And then we headed for Alaska, you know, right after the spring. So probably in June, mid-June, spent 2 months in Alaska, crisscrossing all of Alaska, and then headed back and went through Montana and through, you know, the Rocky Mountains, and then kind of hit southwest after that, and then finished up going to the warm weather parks of the Pacific, so the Haleakala in Hawaii, volcanoes in Hawaii, and American Samoa, and then we finished in Pinnacles National Park in California, so jig-jagging all throughout the country there.
Stephanie, some of these national parks, of course, have a lot of wilderness, a lot of friendly rangers. I wonder if you had any close calls, either with natural phenomena, rivers that are higher than you thought, or maybe a bear that was a little hungry.
I had a pretty challenging meeting with some glacier moraine and tundra in Wrangell St. Elias National Park in Alaska. It's the largest national park in the system in terms of size, and it is just wild and rugged and mean, and that trail just worked me over, and I was in tears many times on this five-day adventure. But it's interesting how that resonates and stays in your memory. You know, Wrangell remains one of my favorite parks of the year because I really pushed myself out there. It's just an experience I'll take forever and remember forever. It was amazing.
We had a lot of crazy experiences like that. I mean, we rented a houseboat in Voyagers and actually ended up on a rock one time. We crashed it on a rock, one of our first crashes of the trip. We were in a bush plane in Alaska that had an engine problem, so we had to make an emergency landing there. We had two flat tires along the trip, and actually hiking out of the Grand Canyon one time, we had a boulder come down from the top of the Grand Canyon and just kind of missed me, probably about 15 feet from me. Really scary experience coming down. So we had a lot of crazy adventures here and there.
To tell me a little bit more about this emergency plane landing, what happened?
Yeah, so we were in Alaska, you have to fly basically everywhere. So we had 24 bush flights throughout our time in Alaska. And this was flying into the gates of the Arctic National Park. And we didn't know much about bush planes at that moment. But a lot of the planes in Alaska are like these old bush planes. And bush planes have two magnetos, which are basically what fires the engine. And so we're flying and everything's fine. And suddenly this one magneto blows. And it was like a huge explosion on the plane. Nothing blew up. It just sounded like a huge explosion. And then the engine died, right? So you have this one suspended moment where there's no engine at all. And you're flying. And that's a very strange feeling. So then the pilot kicks the engine back on and he's like, well, we've got to, you know, make an emergency landing because that's our last magneto. If that one blows, then we're in real trouble. Luckily, there was a lake close by, so we could just, you know, glide down onto the lake.
Because it was a float plane. So had it been a tundra plane, we probably wouldn't have been able to land on that lake. So
yeah,
I want to imagine in this situation that it's like the movies where you had some kind of super confident pilot who just kind of looks over and goes, oh, there's that magneto again. It'll be fine. I hope it was like that.
I thought we were going to die. You know, I had tears running down my face, but he was amazing. In fact, I have a little fear of flying, and I looked at the pilot at that moment to see his reaction, you know, kind of the way if a kid falls, you try not to overreact so as not to scare them. So I always look at the pilot to see if they're freaked out and kind of gauge how I should act from there. And he just looked cool and calm. And so it was okay.
And you'll never be afraid of another commercial flight after those bush planes and after Alaska. Stephanie, people can look at some of the great photographs that you and Jonathan took on thegreatestroadtrip.com and also on our website at thetakeaway.org. But you've seen 59 parks now, and you mentioned you started in Everglades, you're all the way up in Alaska, you're seeing volcanoes, you're seeing Acadia. Can you wrap your head around just the enormous difference, the diversity of what you saw going to all these parks?
No, and they're all so different from one another. And so distinct. And one thing I really love is that just knowing that there were champions in each of the park, you know, that was someone's life's work was to save each particular park. And I just really enjoy knowing that they've always been very important places to people who have gone there.
You know, at the same time, you guys, we were on a recent reporting trip ourselves in Montana. We went to Glacier National Park, which was absolutely beautiful. But there was no way around some bad news in a place like Glacier, which is that the glaciers themselves are disappearing rapidly. The scientists who work there told us they're not coming back because of climate change. You went on a beautiful trip, but I don't think that all of what you saw was probably easy to take in.
No, and another example of that is in Glacier Bay. We met a lot of the local people there who've lived there for 40, 50 years, and they've said that they've seen the ice retreat. They can mark it with their eyes and point to where it was 40 years ago and where it is now. And we're talking hundreds of feet. And that is just amazing to wrap your head around the visible change in that.
And, you know, a lot of people ask us about what we think of that. And really, our goal is to inspire people to care about these places. And through sharing the beauty of them, I think we can do more to inspire people to care about them than to highlight some of the dangers and some of the things that are going on.
59 national parks in the span of 1 year. Jonathan Irish and Stephanie Payne, thank you both so much.
Thank you, Todd, for having us.
Thank you, Todd.
Jonathan Irish is a professional photographer represented by National Geographic, and Stephanie Payne is a communication strategist at NASA. You can find more about their book and some photos from their journey by visiting our website, thetakeaway.org.
This is Darlene from Bend, Oregon. My most memorable visit to a national park was my first day working for the Yosemite Trail Crew in the late 90s, and I couldn't believe that I was about to be paid for working in the greatest place I had ever seen, and that my work days would be spent gazing out in awe and wonder.
This is Laurie in Oakland, California. My most memorable trip to a national park in the U.S. was in May of 2011, when I went to Yosemite for a week with my mom. It was 2 months before she was diagnosed with stage 4 metastatic cancer. We hiked all over the place, and no one knew she was ill because she was so strong and extraordinary.
This is Tim from Charleston, South Carolina. We visited the Mighty Five in Utah last summer. Spectacular parks, clean facilities, and helpful park personnel. A must-do in your lifetime.
Tell us your national park story. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.